Podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. We are going to talk about an article that Christianity Today decided to put out there a few days ago from Richard Mao on theocracy. Can you believe Christianity Today wants to talk about theocracy? I know I couldn't either, which is part of the reason I read it, and it was very interesting their take on this. Of course, it's not what you think. It's not really theocracy in the sense that you usually think of theocracy. It is this idea that God is sovereign, right? And Christ is Lord, and we celebrate and reinforce that on Sunday. But the rest of the week, you should be a good American pluralist. And so Richard Mao argues for this, and I want to go over it because I think he's taking a shot at Christian nationalism, quote unquote, even though he doesn't mention that. But broadly speaking, this idea that there should be a default setting of Christianity and social mores and laws, and that's the foundation. And that's something that he wants to get away from, it seems. So I want to talk about that in this article today. I already wrote a response on TruthScript. And so we are going to get into the details. Before we do, though, I want to mention something coming up, and it's coming up fast. And you're going to want to sign up if you're a guy, because everyone that comes to this conference who I've talked to has had a really good time, at least the people who share with me. Maybe someone hasn't had a good time. They just haven't told me. But the vast majority of people, at least the ones that I've talked to, all have a great time. There's been some lasting relationships at this conference. There's been people from the, we try to pair people from the same area together if they're going to be bunking together. And so it's just scenic, the facilities are great. The scenery is great. The food is great. It's just a great time. And it's in the Adirondack Mountains of New York. You can go to fundamentalsconference.com if you want to find out more about that. I had a few questions about it. I'll just go over briefly. So the theme this year is the fundamentalist. And of course, that's a pejorative today. We're going to talk about that. The history of fundamentalists, the good, the bad, the ugly, whatever. I mean, but we're going to get into that topic and the fundamentals of the faith. And I think that's such an important thing now. I mean, there's been, I'll just say this briefly. I have an episode that I'm going to do on this, I think, soon, but there's been a few occurrences in the last few weeks where there's been these ecumenical moves. One of them, I'll just say one of them, I'll tease this, but Turning Point USA has a very interesting lineup. If you look at the people who they have speaking for them at their pastor's conference, and people are moving into some of the same circles that don't necessarily align theologically on some of these fundamental issues. And the question is, what do you do about that? How can you be a co-belligerent, and how close can you get? We need to talk about some of this. That's one of the reasons we're doing this conference, by the way, because we're entering this new paradigm. But you have Richard Bargas, the head of the IFCA. He knows a thing or two about fundamentalism. We have myself, A.D. Robles, my dad, Scott Harris, and we may add more to this, although it is just a weekend, and we want to make sure you have plenty of time to fellowship and enjoy the great outdoors. This is probably going to be peak fall. We're doing it one week later than we did last year, because last year it was just before the peak, and hopefully we get it dead on center this time, and we get that peak fall experience in the Adirondacks. You can't beat that. But one person did ask me today about the lodging, and there's single occupancy, double occupancy, and triple quad occupancy options. And all this means is that if you want a room to yourself and your own private bathroom, and of course these rooms are heated, they're very nice, then you can pay $310 and you have the food, you have your lodging. It's a really good deal for a weekend, let me tell you. If you don't want that, if you can't afford that, let's say, and double occupancy or triple occupancy are what you can afford, you can let me know when you sign up in the notes. You can say, I want to be with these people. If you have friends that you want to, or you're coming with people and you want to be with them, or your son or something. If you don't, someone today emailed me and said, I'm just coming alone. I'm going to do the triple quad occupancy option if I come. What does that mean? Well, it means we put you with two people, hopefully that are in your area. And many lasting friendships have started because of this. So you're going to want to check it out. Register now if you're a guy. People have come as far as California, as far as Georgia, they'll drive up. People drive from Michigan to come to this particular conference, this retreat. We give it different names every year, but it's hosted by my home church, Grace Bible Church. And it's called the Fundamentals Conference this year, fundamentalsconference.com. Okay, this is the article that I wrote in response to Richard Mao. So if you want an abridged version of what I'm about to say, you can go to truthscript.com and check out the article Reconciled to Trash World by myself, Reconciled to Trash World. Of course, I'm going to be more expansive in my response to this article today, because I think it's important. The ideas that Richard Mao espouses are still out there, and they're dangerous, frankly. They're the kind of ideas that really neutralize Christian involvement. at the very least, they dull the spear. They, whatever pressure that we can apply, and even whatever arguments that we have that we might want to trot out there in the public sphere to support Christianity in a civil sense or a social sense, this really just takes the wind out of those sails. And it really directs Christians towards instead taking that energy and applying it to propping up some kind of pluralism. And people who I'm talking to are already pretty convinced the pluralism thing isn't working out. So the purpose of this podcast isn't to necessarily argue against pluralism, though I may give some arguments against it. The purpose of this is to expose what Christianity Today is doing, and not just Christianity Today, but Big Eva in general. This is a move that they've made for years. They're just still making the same move, using different terms, trying to be clever about it. And it's not clever, and we're on to it. And Richard Mao may be a very nice person on a personal level. That is very possible. I'm very open to that. He gives me that sense if I ever watch his stuff. But he is a man who has done, I believe, immense damage to the evangelical movement. And I'm going to talk about that more as we get into it. Let's start by reading the first part of this article, the first paragraph. That's my article. This article, "Theocracy is Not the Enemy of Pluralism," is the name of the article by Richard Mao. And the subtitle is "God's Rule is Inherently True, and It Doesn't Require That We Force It on Anyone." Okay. That'd be the worst thing, right? To force Christianity on someone. And of course, the Christian flag is the picture for this article. It's the header. Here's the first paragraph. "A liberal acquaintance told me recently that while he generally dislikes evangelicals, he doesn't find me to be as bad as the rest. At least you don't rant about wanting to establish a theocracy. I decided to accept what he said as a compliment, even though I regretted not coming clean with him about theocracy." Now, let me stop there. Let's say this about Richard Mao. He considered this a compliment, and this is something you're going to find across the board in elite circles in evangelicalism. These people, meaning the people running organizations like Christianity Today, they long for when the New York Times gives them a pat on the head. And I can say that after years of watching them. I wouldn't just come out and say that right away if I never met any of these people, but Russell Moore is the editor-in-chief. He has for years wanted that pat on the head from the Washington Post. He has wanted to cultivate friendships, and he's wanted the social capital that comes with these friendships from people that are on the left who have cultural power and cultural influence. And so Richard Mao, in my mind, is no exception. This is the kind of thing that they would be proud of. I would say that's the kind of thing I don't want to hear from my liberal acquaintance, to be quite frank with you. I don't mind, like, if my liberal acquaintance says you're a nice guy and you don't match the stereotypes, that's great. The problem is, of course, the stereotypes. But, you know, I want to be known, you know, we should have a good reputation with liberal, conservative, whoever. We should have a general good reputation that we're honest people, that we follow God's law, we treat people with respect. That's not what I'm talking about here, though. I don't think that's what Richard Mao is talking about. Richard Mao is saying that there's this group of Christians that are political enemies, right? And the liberal recognizes them as political enemies. And the liberal is recognizing Richard Mao is not one of those enemies. He's not the kind of person that represents the religious right in this country that elects people like Donald Trump. And I'll show you in a minute concretely why I say that about Richard Mao. He's definitely not someone who's voting for Donald Trump. And so he gets an exemption. He gets a pass. You know, that's a great compliment to someone like a Richard Mao. Let me give you a little background to Richard Mao before we read more of this article and get into the actual argument. This is from my book, Christianity. Oh, sorry, I'm confusing my books. This is from my first book on social justice called Social Justice Goes to Church, the New Left in Modern American Evangelicalism. You can still get this, johnharrispodcast.com. I'll send you an autographed copy. You can go to Amazon and get it if you want, at Barnes & Noble. It's wherever books are sold. So I talk about Richard Mao quite a bit. In fact, I have a whole chapter 5, that is entitled Richard Mao. Let me read for you. It's pretty short. It's a very short chapter. "Like many of his contemporary young evangelicals, Richard Mao experienced a crisis of faith prompted by the civil rights movement and Vietnam. Ultimately, Mao left fundamentalism over its anti-intellectual behavior, disinterest in social justice, and separatistic spirit. Though his mother was Dutch Reformed, Mao's father was more fundamentalist." There's that word again. "And so many So were many of his earthly influences. He bristled against the legalistic rules inherent to the tradition throughout his young adulthood and while a student at the evangelical Houghton College. As Mao transitioned to secular graduate schools at the University of Alberta and then University of Chicago, he was exposed to new left ideas. Okay, so social justice ideas, but that's what they were called back in the 1960s. Days before starting this new chapter in his life, Mao was profoundly impacted by watching Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech on television. He realized that when evangelicals he respected were often dismissive of, and in some cases even hostile to, the civil rights movement, Mao was equally disappointed in their reaction to Vietnam, an issue he found secular sources to be more helpful in morally navigating than evangelical ones. In his new secular environment, Mao rubbed shoulders with Wittgenstein defenders, Trotskyites, and non-Marxist scholars, or socialists, rather. And he became an organizer in the Students for a Democratic Society, where he participated in political protests. Let me stop. Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, was a radical group that actually spawned, if I remember correctly, the Weather Underground. You know, Bill Ayers, you remember him, his connection to Obama was part of SDS, as I remember, if I remember correctly. It was one of those radical left-wing groups that fomented the kind of campus disruption. We're seeing that kind of thing now with the anti-Israel protests, but back in the 1960s, of course, it was anti-Vietnam protests. And Richard Mao was part of that organization. Not only part of it, he was an organizer for them. So he's way on the left. During this time, he drifted away from Christianity and spent a few years trying not to be an evangelical. So I shouldn't say from Christianity, but from his, you know, the kind of Christianity that he grew up with. Instead, he explored alternative worldviews, enrolled in advanced courses in social thought and ethics, and attended ecumenical chapel services, Catholic masses, and liberal Protestant congregations. However, Mao confessed the new left and the social gospel did not satisfy the deep places in his soul. He needed a place to ground his new moral convictions. And there's many such cases of this, where someone tries to go into these very progressive, maybe more mainline kind of denominations, and they realize there's an emptiness to it. And they yearn for that authenticity that they experienced in more charismatic or evangelical churches or Southern Baptist churches. And they say there is something about that, but they don't want the politics. And so where can we find the social left stuff with whatever that authenticity is? And that was Richard Mao. It was then he discovered Abraham Kuyper and his social thought, which helped him integrate his political activism with his Christian faith. Mao also reached back into his religious memories and imagined a radicalism towards social evil, even in traditional hymns. So he starts reading his new left ideas back into Christianity. And he finds it in the tradition of Dutch Reformed thought and Abraham Kuyper. He's able to take the new left ideas he already had and find a place for them in Kuyper's thinking. That's what he's doing, at least. Some of you who are Kuyper fans are getting upset at this point. I'm the messenger. That's what Mao did. And others who are influenced by him. So anyway, he says he expanded the meaning of I surrender all, you know, the traditional hymn, I surrender all, that hymn, to include corporate concerns such as our racism, our fondness for military solutions, and our ethnocentrism. So we got to surrender those things, right? Mao returned to evangelicalism while altering his version of it as he discovered more nuanced and complex understandings of Christ's love, God's providence, and biblical interpretation. Richard Mao's example, through his writings such as Political Evangelism in 1973, and academic influence, first at Calvin College and then at Fuller Theological Seminary, he was the president of Fuller, helped light the way for other evangelicals attracted to new left ideas. And his became the respected academic voice against the status quo, while another young evangelical, Ron Sider, became the pastoral voice. And that is the role Mao has had for decades now. He's the academic. He's the sophisticated one who shows that these new left ideas, these social justice ideas, really do integrate with Christianity. Now, I'm going to read for you some other shorter sections from my book as we go along and as it's relevant. But that I wanted to read that to you just to give you a heads up on who Richard Mao is, where these ideas are coming from that you're about to interact with a bit. So Richard Mao, we're going back now to the Christianity Today article, second paragraph. Richard Mao says, truth be told, my wife and I do belong to a pro-theocracy organization. Indeed, we attend its meetings every week. In those gatherings, we learn about what it means to support a theocracy, and we sing songs that are meant to strengthen our theocratic commitments. The organization I'm referring to, of course, is our local church. And of course, you know, it's like, I pull the rabbit out of the hat, but no one's impressed. You know, we saw this coming. This is, it's a arrangement of words. It's sophistry. It's not, you know, our local church, because we attend church, we must be theocrats. You know, that would make every Christian who attends church a theocrat. Obviously, that's not what the liberal who complimented Mao was talking about when he was talking about quote unquote theocracy, clearly. Theocracy literally means the rule of God, Mao says. So he's going back to the etymology of the word. You know, this is what the word literally means linguistically. So so anyone who believes in the rule of God must be a theocrat. So he gets to now be part of this. And you think about the play that's being run on you right now. So if you're someone who's concerned about, let's say, Drag Queen Story Hour and concerned about the Biden administration, and I think it's this summer, the Biden administration is rolling out more Title IX regulations that are going to make separating males and females a federal offense, essentially, in the school system. If you're concerned about that kind of thing, then, you know, and you're called a theocrat because of that. You're called a Christian nationalist. You're called pejoratives. You're called a fundamentalist, maybe. Then, you know, you may resonate at least with where Richard Mao's coming from, because he's saying, look, if you just believe in the rule of God, you're a theocrat. And so you look at that and you say, yeah, I believe in the rule of God. Of course. But now he's going to channel that into neutralizing that fervor you have, that concern you have. He's going to neutralize it. He's going to show that, yeah, of course, it's good to be, you can be a theocrat if you believe in the rule of God, but, you know, don't take that out into the public square and start forcing people to operate on Christian assumptions about things. He says the idea of the church as a theocracy, however, is part of a much larger theocratic picture. The universe itself, in all of its complex glory, is a theocracy. The Jewish community, Shabbat prayer, captures well the Bible's theocratic perspective when it begins with, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe." Everything that exists is under God's rule. Now, it's a nitpicky thing, but just notice what he did there. The Jewish community Shabbat prayer, right? So you're about a theocracy, and it's Christian, right? You know, he talks about allegiance to Jesus. In the next paragraph, we're talking about not an Old Testament prayer. We're talking about the Jewish community's Shabbat prayer. And you know, okay, all right. You know, I could go with that. Like, this is an example, but he's already setting up his pluralistic argument to extend the theocratic commitment that you might have to Jews as well, modern Jews who are not Christians. They share this theocratic commitment somehow, right? Already. So there's this watering down going on of a specifically Christian and uniquely Christian commitment to social mores and policy and all of that. He says everything that exists is under God's rule. It is this theocratic arrangement defining the very nature of reality that gives believers meaning and hope in our lives. But does that mean that believers like me should try to turn the United States into a theocracy? I think not. God does not want me to force my theocratic understanding of reality on others. What God wants from people is that they freely offer their obedience to his will. Now, remember what I just read for you, okay? I read for you Richard Mao is a young man. He's got these new left ideas. It doesn't seem like the fundamentalists really that he was part of, those groups are interested in them. And he's not satisfied with the liberal churches because there's just something missing. And so this is the thing I think that's missing. He wants meaning, the meaning and the hope that believers have in their lives as a result of this theocratic arrangement, as a result of believing in the sovereignty of God and truly believing it, right? Not just saying you believe it, but then turning around and, you know, we don't really believe it. It's just a nice story, which is what you'll find in a lot of these mainstream, or I should say mainline churches. Richard Mao wanted the real deal, right? But he didn't want the conservative stuff. He didn't want the fundamentalist stuff. He wanted to have his new left ideas. He wanted to be SDS. He wanted to have the socialist stuff too. And so, so what he's saying is you could be a theocrat, meaning, and you draw from this idea that God is in control, meaning and hope, but, you know, don't go out and try to force any of your morals on others, your uniquely Christian morals. He wants morality force, but not Christian morality. That's the thing. And this is from Christianity Today, though the premier evangelical magazine, supposedly, is telling you, and you'll find this out as I go through some of these other paragraphs, and we get to the end, that Christian morality must never be forced. Uniquely Christian morality, unique to Christians. It can't be forced on non-Christians. It can't be forced as a universal or something that's even not a, you know, unique to your society. You need some things that apply to everyone, that everyone can participate in and kind of rally around. But for you personally, it's really good to think about Christianity as something that gives you comfort because God's in control. So he wants his cake and he wants to eat it too, because the leftist stuff, you know, that applies to everyone. That's not uniquely Christian. That's everyone's. So we can be for that. And where there happens to be, let's say, an overlap, we can be Christians in that sense. We can say, you know, when we're doing this because our motive is Christianity and it's rooted in Christianity. That's why we're fighting for social justice. But it's something that's, you know, applies to everyone. It's not uniquely Christian. Here's another paragraph, the next one. I do not serve God's purpose in the world by trying to impose Christian laws on people against their own values and convictions. Okay, so that doesn't serve God's purpose. I should not want everything that I consider to be sinful to be made illegal. For example, and he says I don't like blasphemous language on television. I hear it on Netflix. So he hears this on Netflix. He goes, I'm not inclined to call for laws banning these expressions. Well, let me ask you this. Maybe you don't think you have the political will to do something like that, and that may be. But if you did, wouldn't you want that? Wouldn't you want to clean up the airwaves? If it's not going to be the Hays Code and they're not going to manage themselves, don't you want the FCC? If they're going, you know, if the will is there to do it, don't you want them to ban some things, you know, blasphemy being one of them? He says no, he doesn't want that. He's not inclined to call for laws banning these expressions. Why? Because it violates some higher law. What's that higher law? Is it Christian? No. He may think it is, I don't know, but it's this secular, pluralistic, neutral space that we all somehow occupy. Christians and Muslims and atheists and Jews, and goes down the line, right? We are all in that. And we all have certain expectations and a moral code that is universal to all of us and not uniquely Christian. And we can impose that code, but we can't impose Christianity because that's not unique. An atheist might think blasphemy is fine. So we should allow blasphemy, right? I think that's the logic that you're hearing here. That does not mean, he says, that I should withdraw into a live and let live posture, content to wait for Jesus to return. The Bible makes it clear that God wants me to be active in the society where he has placed me. All right, so here's the conundrum, right? God wants you to be active, but don't ever force his laws on people that aren't Christians. Don't do that, but you should be active. What does that activity look like? Well, I gave you a preview in my book from my chapter 5. Let me give you some more from my book, and I'll explain what this means. Richard Mao. Let's go to his why this is important. I probably should have started with this, but we'll go to this now. Richard Mao's influence on modern evangelicalism, that's today, cannot be underestimated. He serves both as the president of Fuller Theological Seminary, or he served, I should say, till 2013, and the Association of Theological Schools, and continues to speak at places like Dort University, Pepperdine University, Southern Seminary, and Wheaton College, and Northeastern University. His writings are featured on BioLogos, in all things, First Things, and Christianity Today. He has also contributed to think tanks influential in many evangelical seminaries, such as the Oikonomia Network and the Acton Institute. Mao received a Lifetime Achievement Award from Christians for Biblical Equality, whose mission is to eliminate the power imbalance between men and women resulting from theological patriarchy. Well, he doesn't have a problem, I guess, going against patriarchy. As well as the Abraham Kuyper Prize for Excellence in Reformed Theology and Public Life from Princeton Theological Seminary. Russell Moore called Mao a friend I've respected all my adult life, who has done some masterful scholarly work on the nature of the kingdom. Bruce Ashford, the former provost at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and this is dated because when I wrote this, he was still somewhat influential. Now, there's a whole scandal surrounding him, or I shouldn't say there's a scandal surrounding him. I'll take that back. Let's just say Bruce Ashford has had it rough since he left Southeastern. But when he was there, and I was there during the time he was a provost, he was very big into Mao. He said in his book, One Nation Under God, I'm especially indebted to Richard Mao, whose writings have helped me understand what public faithfulness might look like in an increasingly plural and post-Christian America. And many of his students were classmates of mine. And this goes along with the article we're reading from Christianity Today by Mao. This idea that things are getting increasingly pluralistic and post-Christian, and Mao's the one that's going to help you navigate it. Mao has the key. Mao has the answer. He can show you as a Christian how you get through this and keep your Christian convictions. No one, however, carries Mao's influence farther than Tim Keller, a popular author, former pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York City, and co-founder of the Gospel Coalition, who repeatedly cites Mao in his work. And I go into some of the detail on this. In Generous Justice, God's Gospel and Life Study Book or Study Guide, Cultural Engagement, Center Church, Every Good Endeavor. I mean, it's just like so many of Tim Keller's works, he is drawing on Richard Mao's influence. Very influential, because not because of Richard Mao, people are reading him, but not as many as are reading someone like a Tim Keller. And that's how his influence has gotten out there. You don't necessarily need to ever hear the name Richard Mao. So think about what Tim Keller's done and his project, his Kuiperian project. Think about the Gospel Coalition and what they've done. And they're Kuiperian, right? And what kind of Kuiperian? Richard Mao's Kuiperian. Yeah, every square inch belongs to Jesus Christ. God is sovereign, theocracy, but you better hold on to that and don't let it run roughshod over secular pluralism, because that pluralism, that's really important to maintain. I'll explain a little more about how he sees this in Kuiper in a moment. But let's keep going with this Christianity Today article. Mao quotes the Apostle Peter. He says, the Apostle Peter puts the mandate, as we just saw in the previous paragraph, which is to be active in society. He puts that mandate this way: live such good lives among the pagans that they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. 1 Peter 2:12. Peter, he says, is echoing the admonition of God that God gave through Jeremiah when the people of Israel were exiled in the pagan city of Babylon. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. In addition to witnessing to others about the power of the gospel, we can join them in working for God-glorifying social goals. And let's stop there and talk about this. Can you lock arms with someone who does not share your theological commitments? Maybe they can't justify even the moral position that you're both advocating for. Can you lock arms with them and say, we're both going to vote in this direction or support this policy, or we're going to make sure that our children are not groomed in class? Well, yeah, you can. Absolutely, you can. Why not? There's no biblical that's not having fellowship with darkness, because you're not sharing something in common with darkness. This is actually something that is very good, positive. It's light. This is something that's it may be even a natural instinct that God has placed in unbelievers, in all people, including unbelievers. And you see this throughout scripture. You see, Jesus said that even the evil fathers will give their son a fish when he asks for one. You see in the rich man and Lazarus, someone that's heading for hell is concerned about their family. You see that you're worse than an unbeliever if you don't provide for your family. So unbelievers, I guess, they do something good when they provide for their, right? So there's this creational instinct that God has placed in people. And that can be perverted, and that can be, subdued and that kind of thing. But that's the way that God designed people. It was his original intention. You can link arms with someone who wants to protect their children and feed their children. Absolutely. That's not partnering with darkness. But you better not give the impression that the foundation for what you're doing is from their, let's say they're an atheist, from their atheist worldview. You better not endorse their particular brand of Mormonism, let's say, and calling it Christianity, which is happening all too often today. And I'm seeing it more and more. You can do what Richard Mao's talking about, right? But it doesn't mean that, now you're locked into it's the least common denominator. So what I guess democracy decides is moral. You can support that. But if people don't decide that, and if it's too Christian, you can't. Like, that's ridiculous. I'm grateful, he says, for the opportunity to live in a pluralistic society where I can learn from people with whom I seriously disagree about religious beliefs, public policy, and moral lifestyles. For one thing, I can learn about the mistakes and misdeeds that Christians like me have made in the past. I really hate the way that sounds. And still make today about important matters. I just imagine Richard Mao, I'm not saying he does this, but I'm like envisioning him at the LGBT pride parade or something. And, learning the evil things that Christians have done from the gay activists or something. And, so good to live in this plural society to learn. Yeah. To learn from people who have a very broken moral compass. You're going to take your cues from them. If there's people who are not Christians who want to support a Christian thing, great. But I don't go to the world to say, hey, could you critique us? Could you tell us like what we're getting wrong? I'm not saying you can't listen to any wisdom outside of what an Orthodox Christian teaches. There is, of course, there's worldly wisdom you want to watch out for based on the principles of that the world thinks are important. But there is a certain experiential, I think, kind of knowledge that, just older people have and people who have lived in society, they should have. You can listen to that. But to frame it this way, that like that's really the positive thing about pluralism. We need it. We Christians need these other faith traditions to critique them or something. Don't you know the saints are going to judge the world, Richard Mao? You seem like you have it a little backwards here, but this would be a good time for me to read another excerpt, the last excerpt that I want to read from my book, Social Justice Goes to Church. And it explains how Mao uses Kuiper to justify his political leftist views. I'm trying to think where I want to start with this. So Mao wrote a book, okay, 1974. There was, I think the book was actually 1973, yeah. It's called Political Evangelism. I actually have it. And his thesis was that political action was an aspect of the evangelistic task of the church. For Mao, a full gospel concerned with the whole man meant that Christ's atoning work offered liberation for people in their cultural endeavors, including political institutions and the making of public policy. This discovery fundamentally altered the evangelistic endeavor by recruiting Christians to participate in the redemption and transformation of institutional life. Proclaiming the Christian gospel included confronting, quote, sinful structures, unquote. In a 1974, 2 years later, article in the Post-American, that's Jim Wallace's outlet, Mao explained, the payment that Jesus made through his shed blood was a larger payment than many fundamentalists had seemed to think. For even when they have sung the words with zeal, they have not seemed to acknowledge in their political and social lives that Jesus did indeed pay it all. He died to remove the stains of political corruption and of all forms of human manipulation and exploitation, and he calls us to witness to and enjoy the first fruits of that full redemption. So you're going to hear words when you start getting into these social justice circles like full gospel, full redemption, partial gospel. They're trying to say that there's something lacking in the conservatives. The conservatives, the fundamentalists, really the Orthodox, to be honest with you, they don't really have the full gospel because their good news doesn't include all these great socialist things or politically left things. In this concept of redemption, Christ's payment for sin could potentially extend to human structures in which the majority of participants may not even be Christians. Can you imagine that? Think of like a prison system where no one's saved, the guards aren't saved, but it's now redeemed through the blood of Christ somehow. The motivation behind political evangelism was simply the desire that political processes and policies preserve and promote the dignity of individuals. This broadening of Christ's atoning work as a way to liberate individuals in their cultural endeavors, including the building of political institutions, fit well into, surprise, surprise, 19th century Dutch theologian Abraham Kuyper's theology of common grace. Kuyper, whose writings Mao credited with helping him reconcile his political and religious beliefs, wrote about three kinds of grace from God. Now, you got to listen carefully. This is where we get theological. There's a particular grace which applies to individual believers, okay? And we all know what that is, right? When we sing Amazing Grace, we're talking about that. There's a covenant grace which applied to the community of saints. And then there's a common grace which applied to mankind as a whole. This is in Kuiper's framework, okay? And so there's a certain grace that God extends to the church as an institution or as a corporate body, universally. There's the grace that believers receive in salvation, and there's a common grace which applies to all mankind. Now, you heard me just describe what I would consider to be, I guess, a natural instinct. I think instinct's the word I use. Maybe that's not the best word, but just a natural part of the natural design that God has baked into creation, that we are naturally inclined towards loving those people who are in proximity to us and taking care of children and that kind of thing. That's a natural thing. Kuiper takes that, these natural things, right, that really scholastic theologians have talked about, but this goes back to the early church fathers. This is across the board until recently. This was viewed as part of God's natural order. He takes that and he makes that into that. That's common grace now. This is like a special, I shouldn't mix up the words here. This is a common grace. So he puts it in a different category, I would say. He taught that God's common grace was responsible for things as varied as prosperity and health, philosophy, art, justice, classical studies, human virtue. It reigned in the curse of sin and served as the foundation for saving grace in unbelievers. That's a key thing. It was the foundation for saving grace. It's the only reason that believers were able to ascertain salvation is because they already had this common grace in them. This, if it sounds a little Arminian to you, some people have critiqued it that way and said, yeah, it does seem like there's like the spark of good or something. Well, it's like common grace. Kuiper even referred to common grace as a work of redemption displayed by the reality of life itself. So there's the lines are fuzzy between redemption, between special grace and saving grace, we'll say, and common grace in Kuiper's framework. Kuiper scholars Jordan Baylor and Stephen Graybill state common grace, as Kuiper conceived it, was a theology of public responsibility and cultural engagement rooted in Christian shared humanity with the rest of the world. Now, hopefully light bulbs are going off. Oh yeah, that sounds like the pluralism he's talking about. It's a universal shared thing with everyone, even those who aren't Christians. And it's so it can be Christian because it's God's common grace, but at the same time, you know, Hindus also have this. So we can work with them. This is the basis for it. It provided a point of contact with the world whereby the church could appreciate the spark of common grace within unbelievers and cooperate with the purpose of shared political goals that serve the common good and furthered human flourishing. Kuiper maintained that God's grace cooperated with particular grace, or saving grace, you could say, I suppose, in amazing harmony to direct God's work. Richard Mao later spoke of common grace as God's desire to see cultural development move forward in creation, even under sinful conditions. So now you should be thinking about all the social justice stuff and how so many wanted to get their cues from Kendi. And well, I think of Woke Church, Eric Mason. He said the denazification program in Germany and the anti-apartheid program in South Africa, these are good examples of how to apply or how to live out. I forget how he put it, but Christians can learn from them because it concerns the gospel. These are good examples of how to live out the gospel. You're thinking these people aren't even Christians. How is that possible? It's because of this common grace stuff. That's what it does. People are going to be mad at me for this. I'm already anticipating it. John, how can you say that about common grace? John MacArthur uses the word common grace. Well, clearly Richard Mao is not talking about John MacArthur. He's talking about Kuiper and a particular reading of Kuiper. I could go on. There's other people, Wes Granberg Michelson, Sharon Gallagher, and others also tried to use this idea of common grace to justify their political leftism. And you can read more about it in Social Justice Goes to Church, The New Left and Modern Even American Evangelicalism. It's important to note, he didn't get the leftism, I think, from Kuiper. He got the leftism from going to these secular institutions that were leftist. What he found was able to make his leftism compatible with his Christianity. Back to the article, okay? Now that we're understanding Richard Mao and hopefully the wider evangelical world, including the influence of Tim Keller and the Keller Center and the Gospel Coalition. Historically, Mao says, American evangelicals have gone back and forth between two ways of relating to the larger culture. So he talks about in the 1950s, there was this apolitical stance. He says we like to sing patriotic songs. Preachers regularly reminded us that we had a Christian obligation to show up as voters on election day, but we typically did not actively engage in political advocacy. To be an evangelical citizen was to cast our votes for Republican candidates, to pray for God's blessing, In all this, we were passive about politics and, you know, believed in the one nation under God. Now, you know, this is probably pretty standard and still today in many churches where there's just this instinct of like, we're on the right. I mean, because evangelicalism, Orthodox Christianity is going to naturally always be on the right. That's just, you can't force it into something else, despite what Richard Mountain or Russell Moore want to do. But there was this understanding of what I think Aaron Redd calls positive world, where we don't need specific Christian activists or political representation, because we live in this world that already favors Christianity. We have politicians, we have representatives, we have institutions. We don't need Christian ones to advocate for Christians, because our institutions already advocate for Christians, right? That was the mentality. He talks about that. So that's one option. Option two, 1980, the new Christian right, led by Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, they became aggressively political, working for candidates to promote godly causes and explicitly guided by a theocratic project of returning to the vision of a Christian America. Okay. And those are the bad guys usually in the story, right? Because they became active and used the used Christians, really not maybe the church in some situations too, but they used Christians to promote their uniquely Christian morality, policy, cultural mores, all of that. Thus, he said, we have distanced ourselves from active involvement in the political system or worked to take it over. And he just assumes these are both bad stances. You can't be in either of these. These are two options that you should not choose. We were cognitively a minority, content to sing as we did in my youth. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. Or we proclaimed ourselves to be a moral majority, boldly belting out, shine, Jesus, shine, fill this land with the Father's glory. He likes to use songs a lot. Have you noticed that about Richard Mao? The people who actually read him, I don't know if he's a musical guy or what, but that's what he's looking at. He's saying there's this aggressive type, there's this type that is passive, and we can't be either of those, right? Those are scary. Those are either scary or just useless. We can't be that. Of course, though, he says there's a third option. Well, what would that be? One desperately needed today in our increasingly polarized society, this third option, an evangelical willingness to labor patiently alongside others, persons of other faiths and of no faiths at all, in seeking workable solutions to the complex challenges we face as a nation. So is blasphemy on television a challenge? That's the question I'd have for him. He said, of course, you know, I'm not going to work towards that. Well, that's a challenge we face, right? It's a complex thing. Technology is involved. Policy across state lines is involved. You know, how does that work? Free speech and all that, you know, that's a complex challenge we face. But no, I guess we don't work on that one. We work on stuff that applies to everyone, stuff that's pluralistic, stuff that falls under common grace, right? That's what we work on. And our weekly theocratic gatherings, so cringy. We evangelicals tell God in our human, our prayers rather, our hymns, our sermons about our spiritual weaknesses as vulnerable human creatures. When we walk into church, we also bring with us the hopes and fears that we experience in our political lives. The self-righteousness that we so often exhibit in the public square does not fit well with what we know about ourselves and our deep place. So this is another strategy I've seen with people who will tell other Christians, will tell evangelicals who are involved in social or political things, like, how much time did you pray today? The whole thing is to like guilt you. It's like, are you really a good person? Do you really have business trying to purify the world when your soul's not pure? And the answer to that question, of course, is yes, I do. Sure, I'm always going to have sin on some level. I'm getting sanctified, but that does not mean that I don't have a responsibility to feed my children, right? I keep using that example because it's so fundamental and people get it. Like, just because, let's say, I have a sin that I'm struggling with, does that mean I don't feed my kids? Right? Do two wrongs make a right? No. This is really basic stuff. But Richard Mao wants to say, you know, we're critiqued by the world. That's so good. That's pluralism right there. It helps us. And then we're so self-righteous. Look at his view of Christians and his view of the world. You know, he's admitting in this article that he lives under the gaze of the non-Christian liberal, who he just wants that approval. He wants the critique too. He wants to know what they think, and what we think must be backwards. And it's just, we mess it up when we try to go into the public square. We can't do it. We can't be Christians and do it. We got to link arms with all these other people who apparently have some wisdom that I guess Christians just don't seem to have. All we have is God's word. I mean, my goodness. One of the heroes of the faith, he says, is Abraham Kuyper. Oh, wow. How did he get in here? He proclaimed his inaugural address at the university he founded. There is not a square inch in the whole domain of our lives. Long story short, let's see where Christ says mine, right? That's the famous quote. I find that inspiring manifesto to be a motivation for how I am to live as a theocrat in contemporary life. There's always a temptation for us to answer that rallying cry in an arrogant and imperialistic manner, as if all we have to do is go out there and grab hold of all those square inches in the name of Jesus. Properly understood, though, theocracy requires a humble spirit. Peter tells us that we need to give a reason for the hope that we have in Christ with gentleness, respect. So Jesus claims every square inch of creation as his own. Wherever he goes in our lives, we are standing on sacred ground. So he's saying really the whole thing here is that it's vague, but he's throwing out these appeals to humility and to be more reasonable and gentle and to do so according to whose terms, though. That's like the Bible does say to be these things. According to who? According to whose version of gentleness? God's or what the world perceives as gentle? That's the question. And I don't think he does a good job with this, because if you read the article, you get the impression he's saying the world, what they think is gentle. So we don't go and we don't claim these things for Jesus. They already belong to him. Yeah, of course he has his crown rights are on every atom. He doesn't, obviously. That's not the point, though. It's not, he gives us stewardship. That from the beginning, Adam had a task, right? God owned, this isn't a perfect state, too. God owned the whole world. All the animals, everything was in a good state, but Adam had a job to organize, to take dominion. Eve was his helpmate in that. So, you know, there is a purpose, a structure, and this was out in public. And when sin came, of course, there was the fall and the curse of sin. And of course, now we have a law that we are to keep. We have purposes. We have three purposes in the law, right? The law does function to convict us of sin. The law does function in a way to tell us what the right thing to do is, but it also restrains sin. It also, when the government uses it, helps us to carve out what a decent and quiet life looks like. That's why we should pray for those in authority, right? If we have their favor to live that decent and quiet life, what are they doing? They're holding back the dam. they're helping to bring that aspect of the law that restrains the evil forces of sin. I don't even know where to go from. So we're landing the plane. And someone criticized me, by the way, the other day. Say, who was it? I think it was That Brian on Twitter. That Brian. He said he does. You know, we shouldn't, evangelical podcasters shouldn't say landing the plane at the end of their podcast. And that means I'm just going to land the plane even harder, Brian. I'm sorry. We're about to land the plane. In my evangelical youth, I was taught Hudson Taylor's famous saying. Of course, I love Brian. Okay, so nothing personal. I was taught Hudson Taylor's famous saying, Christ is either Lord of all or is not Lord of all. I keep learning more about what it means to represent the cause of the gospel in a gentle and respectful manner. The God whose majesty we theocrats worship not only sends us into the world over which he rules, but assures us that wherever we go, he will be with us. He invites us to join him in those square inches that are occupied by precious human beings who suffer. Let's see. We live in times when our fellow human beings desperately need evangelicals for whom being theocratic means actively serving the cause of a loving savior. So he's saying, for those scary types, those theocratic types, those Christian nationalist types, those fundamentalist types, those religious right types, you know, that this is the category we're talking about. For those guys, then, you know, what the world needs, again, framing it in terms of what's the world think? What do they need? They need to see us channeling all of that energy and all, you know, all that rage you have about what's happening in the schools to your kids or whatever in society, what the parade that went down the street from you the other month, last month, you know, all the rage you have about these things and a righteous indignation, you channel that into something else, channel that into just really being winsome. He doesn't use the word, but that's what this is about. I hope that me going over this article, giving you some background who Richard Mouw is, I mean, he's one of the founding fathers of progressive evangelicalism, gives you a fuller understanding with what we're still facing. It's not just Tim Keller and Russell Moore. It's all their proteges. It's the Keller Center at the Gospel Coalition. It's, you know, the people involved in this whole project are trying to convince you desperately that all is peace when there is no peace. They say peace, peace. There is no peace. There's there's war, and you're in it, and it's coming for you whether you want it to or not. And if you choose to, and really Richard Mao, this is the funny part to me. If you choose to be like Richard Mao and put your head in the sand about those things, you know, he wants to use the profanity on TV episode because maybe that's less controversial, but what about, or blasphemy on TV? What about, something that's a little more current, or at least debated more currently? You know, what about transgender athletes? You know, what does Richard Mao do with something like that? Does that get put in the category of common grace? And this isn't uniquely Christian. Do you bring your Christian motivation to it? What? He wants to knock the people that he calls fundamentalists he grew up with because they weren't involved enough. And that wasn't the way to go. But really what he's calling you to do is to not be involved in certain things. Certain things the world doesn't want you to be involved with. But be involved in these social justice things. That's fine. Be involved in that. That's being a true Christian. It's, I think, internally self-refuting. I think it's hypocritical. And I think it's a play that's being run on you. It is to neutralize you. And that's why I called this in the article that I wrote about it being reconciled to Trash World. And if you want a shorter version to share, in fact, I would appreciate it if you share this article called Reconcile to Trash World on your social media. And it gives this argument, not only gives the argument in a shorter form, but it helps support TruthScript. We need to be answering these things and in a clear way, not just what I see from a lot of guys who are evangelicals on the right, who don't like what Richard Mao's doing, people like him. They just become very aggressively pro right wing, which, you know, okay. I'm not complaining about being that, but they want to just, sometimes I don't think we necessarily understand where the other side's coming from, the deceitful tactics that are being used against us. And it's not just a left-right thing, I guess is what I'm trying to say. It's not just like they're on the left, let's be on the right. It's more than that. There is a conflation going on with these more left-leaning evangelicals where they see the gospel itself. I mean, we're talking about fundamental doctrines here. They see redemption as part of the social justice project somehow. They Christianize that whole movement. So it's not just being on the left and like you're a leftist Christian, I'm on the right. Like Christians on the right aren't on the right saying generally, I don't see this, like, hey, you want to have the gospel, you want to be a real Christian, then you got to do these things. You got to be an activist like me. You got to support these policies. You got to vote this way. I don't really see that. I do see people saying we should be involved. We should, like what I'm saying right now is we should support Christian public morality and flesh that out, what that means for you, because God might have a different way that, you know, different application for you than me. But what we don't see me saying or others who are like-minded, we don't say like, well, if you really want to be a real Christian and have the gospel, then you better go out and support the Second Amendment. That doesn't happen. We just say that that's ethically in keeping with our Christian commitments, our cultural Christian commitments. That's what we'll say. But for the left, it's not that. And it's not, and I'm even searching for words myself. It's not even just the left. Like this is culty stuff that you're reading from Richard Mao in a mainstream, supposedly Christian magazine. Like this is fusing together a new religion is what's going on here. So if you want to know more, you know, again, I've written about a lot of this in Social Justice Goes to Church. Check that book out. God bless. And don't forget to sign up for the men's retreat. We'll talk about some of this stuff. Fundamentalsconference.com again is the website. You don't want to miss this. You really don't. So many of the guys that go to this tell me like, this is the conference I don't want to miss. This is the experience I really enjoy of any weekend conference. You know, I could go to other places that, you know, if you're a man, you know, you could go to the AC room, that's got drywall everywhere and, you know, be with a bunch of strangers and meet some people you'll never actually talk to and try to get their autograph maybe and say thanks and that's it. You know, you could do that thing and spend a lot of money getting there and paying for your hotel and I'm not saying that's all wrong. That's good. I mean, I go to conferences like that sometimes, but I just think for most guys, this is so much more rewarding. You're out in nature. You can kayak, you can fish, you can go hiking, you can actually spend time with guys. You can pray together whenever you can be in your environment with other guys. And that's why people are smiling in this picture. So there you go. Check it out. Fundamentalsconference.com. God bless. More coming.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Back to school savings are officially in session at Tanger Outlets. Shop tax-free July 30th through August 8th and save up to 70% off the latest school styles. The best of apparel, footwear, accessories, and more. Save at Nike Factory Store, American Eagle, Gap Outlet, Crocs, Under Armour, Banana Republic Factory, and hundreds more. There's always something happening. Discover the latest fun and events all season long. Tanger Outlets, your savings destination.